You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
When, you know, they don't feel like the term fits them, so I think a lot of people out there feel like a lot of blacks in America are being slapped with a one label fits all type of deal when that's not the case. What do you think?
You know, I'll be honest with you. You know, I mean, like I've been kind of sticking by the same deal here. What I've been saying is that, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I don't think it's a big deal. You know, I think they should just, like I said, be glad that they're not getting called the N-word on a daily basis and keep it moving. That's kind of where I'm at. I mean, unless the term is getting ready to make, like, black people start going to get paid a whole bunch of money for using the term, I really don't see what good it's doing.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? What did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man come in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Americans keep telling pollsters they like him personally, don't like his policies, but they like him personally. He's our first black president, and the NFM, the non-Fox media, is gaga about him. Obama isn't mawkish like Carter. He's not sleazy like Clinton. He'd probably make a lovely next-door neighbor, as long as you're not Chinese, and he'd be constantly borrowing stuff. Voters with 40 years of politically correct education are ecstatic to have the first black president. They just love the idea of it, even if we did get Flavor Flav instead of Thomas Sowell.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Saluton and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian. Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from ang-newswire.blogspot.com and at aboriginalpress.wordpress.com. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, and neo-fascist control. I wish you all welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. Shout out to the gods and earths and peace to the original family at this time in strife and struggle. You see what's happening out here. You see what's happening out here. There's so much confusion that is unreal. It's unreal. And I really don't even know where to begin. But you know, let's begin with the mainstream population for one, and let's just get that out of the way. Here you have the mainstream United States American population, the white Anglo-Saxon paradigm, because that's what it is. See, you know, when they talk about American culture, what they're really talking about is WASP culture. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant that they have simply renamed and repackaged as American culture. There is no such thing as American culture. If you want to talk about, you know, when Newt Gingrich was talking about the Palestinians being an invented people, you can't be any more invented than the white man in America. And when immigrants come here, who should know better, they really believe that, you know, this was always a part of Europe. Because, I mean, what else is it? In a cultural sense, in a political sense, this, you know, from, Nunavut, all the way down to Argentina and to the Falklands, where they're about to get into it again. David Cameron is no different than Margaret Thatcher. He's looking towards the past. You know, she was all gaga. I mean, really look at the archive films of Thatcher, and you can see that she was not living in the real world. She was living somewhere in the past. And we all know where. We all know where. When someone could walk down Brick Lane and you didn't see a brown face. Look at the older episodes of Coronation Street and EastEnders. How many people of color did you see on those shows? You know, Australian television, the same thing. I mean, when you usually saw a black fellow, what was he doing? He was shining someone's shoes. He was helping a tracker. You know, even though he did most of the work, the white tracker got most of the credit. Yeah? You know, the indigenous people there, you know, show that the white man something, and then the white man turns around and says, "Hey, I found this." Isn't that what Christopher Colombo did with the Americas? He never even stepped on the continent proper. He landed in what's now the Dominican Republic or Haiti, depending on who you are. Hispaniola, well, according to him. But same island, split in half, down racist lines. Right? Went down, you know, kind of off the coast of Nicaragua with his buddy, Albergo, who changed his name to Amerigo after he met the Americae, who the Spanish called Los Americae, in what's present-day Nicaragua. You know, the people where we actually get the name from. And in their language, it meant the land of strong winds. The people of the lands of strong winds. Now, in North America, we like to use the term, or we've agreed, anyways, come to a consensus that we will say Turtle Island. But, you know, and that's cool. But I prefer the Americas, because the Americas has much more to do with us. Yeah, I mean, Turtle Island does, you know, of course, but and turtles have specific meanings for specific peoples. Anywhere you go. It is a very common motif, if you will. And it has a lot of different meanings, some spiritual, some in terms of basic common sense. In some cultures, you have turtles that teach, you know, patience and what have you. Okay, fine. That's cool. A lot of us understand that. But when we look at symbolism, I'm talking about indigenous symbolism, one of the oldest symbols used which was completely ripped off and ruined by the Germans. And not just Hitler, because he wasn't the only one. And even though she wasn't really German, she was Russian, Madame Helena Blavatsky. We're going to get off into some metaphysical stuff here for a moment, because it's important. Because we're talking about fascism. And the majority of people who, you know, when you mention the term fascism to them, you know, they can only think of one thing. And that's Nazi Germany between 1933 and 1945. They can't think of anything else. The Charlie Chaplin mustache, the uniforms, right, designed by Hitler, worked out by Hugo Boss, who's still in business. Just like the German banks right now that are holding up the euro. I mean, this Greek haircut that's going down, and they're already rioting today in Spain. They're talking about Italy tomorrow. Britain, well, is every day, isn't it? The United States is almost every day, right? You know, the Western world, all of Europe, the white man's world is falling apart. And we're going to listen to Pat Buchanan, who, you know, we don't like here, for the obvious reasons. Pat Buchanan is a fascist, but he's a fascist in the American sense, and at least he's honest about it. He's a populist, and he'll tell you in a second. I mean, this is why he just got fired from MSNBC, not because of what he said, just because he won't shut up about it. See, unlike Fox, you know, they say something and then they back off. And then they say, did we insult somebody? Oh, we're sorry. And then they say something else. I mean, did you hear Liz Trotter? You know, if you're a female, you know how many people in my family are in the military? You know, it's just an Indian thing, right? It's just an Indian thing, right? You know, fighting for something that we don't even own. But okay. So, you know, we're looking at this. And what are we seeing here? What we're seeing is total mayhem on a national scale. You know, the entire population here is losing its collective fucking mind. You know, this black man in the White House is driving everybody crazy, even though he's not doing a goddamn thing for black people. And I defy anyone to challenge me on that. Let me know, you know, Aboriginal Radio at lavabit.com. If you can show me where he's done something, I would really like to see it, you know, because I'm really tired of hearing people who are talking about what kind of a great job that he's doing. Maya Angelou, I'm trying to be nice here, you know. It's like, you know, Maya Angelou is a goddamn institution. She's a standard, right? You know, some will go as far as to say the Voltaire for the African community in the United States. Okay, that's cool. But I also know that she's part of the, I don't want to get into this whole thing about the Boule, because, you know, even though, you know, I'm pretty sure that they're, you know, I mean, it's a real fraternity as far as I understand. But I know for those of you who listen to these crackpots, and you know who I'm talking about. These crackpots, and we have to accept something in the Native and African communities. If you have morons, I mean complete morons, and I'm talking about anybody on Fox, Ann Coulter that you heard on your way in here with her damn Flavor Flav remark, totally ridiculous, unnecessary. And see, if you said something like that, they'd all be bitching and whining and talking about how this is unfair and how, you know, all, you know, the left, because everybody who doesn't agree with them is on the left, right? No matter how you vote, no matter what else you do, no matter what your actual political philosophy is, if you don't agree with them, you're on the left. But then again, this is a sign of fascism. I mean, Bush the second made it quite clear. If you're not with us, you're against us. He didn't really clarify who us was, though. Because, I mean, you know, if you remember when he was good for talking about how many Negroes he had in his cabinet, how many Asians he had in his cabinet, right? You know, how many Indians he had lunch with. He could do all of that. And Colin Powell was waved around like a flag. And then when he became useless because he started to, well, I heard, you know, even though, look, I have to be very serious about this. I mean, he is a house Negro. He knows he is. And I say the same thing about, you know, J.C. Watts, Alan Keyes, Alan West, the pizza man, Herman Cain. It goes without without saying. These are house Negroes. These are not conservatives. They're not black conservatives. You know, if you want to talk about black conservatism, we can do that. Barack Obama is a black conservative. Let me say that again if you didn't hear it. You know, I mean, Barack Obama is a black conservative. Let that trickle down for a minute. Maya Angelou is a black conservative. Let that trickle down for a minute. These are black conservatives, not black Republicans. There's a big difference. You see, Alan Weston and Herman Cain, if you noticed, their whole time in politics, J.C. Watts, all of them, they never discussed race. Michael Steele, you think I forgot about him? No, I didn't forget about him. None of them ever talk about race, other than to say that it doesn't exist. And to say that the only reason there's still a problem is because you got these troublemaking Negroes that keep making trouble. They keep talking about it. So as long as they keep talking about it, it's always going to be here. Now, that's nonsense, of course. It's complete nonsense. And, you know, the same charge can be leveled against Maya Angelou. I mean, of course, she has dealt with the trials and tribulations of the black woman in the Americas. And by extension, the African male. But, you know, let's be serious. She has not gone on a platform and talked about police brutality against African people. She hasn't gone on a platform talking about health. And if she has, please correct me, but I'm not aware of it. Because she has the power to have that kind of influence and weight on that kind of a discussion. And here's where I'm coming from with this. Now, you just had the Komen Foundation, which I never really cared for anyway. And I'm going to be honest with you. I don't believe in charities anymore. Now, I believe in charity, but I don't believe in charities. And like I said, I was, you know, Catholic worker. Now, and here's where I'm coming from on this. You'd be hard-pressed to prove to me that the majority of that money that's collected for cancer, be it breast cancer, lung cancer, cancer, actually goes to the recipients. The majority of the money that's collected for HIV and AIDS, you know, where is it going? And you know, come on, you know, I'm old enough to remember when they used to have these stars and they would parade them on, you didn't have that many networks at the time, CBS, NBC, what have you. They would bring them on, and it seemed like, you know, these actors, these celebrities, the politicians would trip over themselves to say, yeah, well, I knew somebody that died from cancer. Please send us your money. Now, I've always had a problem. I've always had a problem with this. Now, if cancer is that big of a deal, which of course it is, and it's becoming even more of a big deal, as more as you eat more of this sugar-laden, chemically birthed non-food, you know, the more of you are going to die. I mean, keep eating meat, especially red meat, and eventually you will get sick. You will more than likely develop cancer. The information, I mean, they've known this since the 50s. The more red meat you eat, the more damage it does to your body, the more damage it does to your cells, the more fat that's accumulated in your bloodstream, the more toxins and all the crapola that's coursing through your system. You know, you got to get rid of it. And I'm going to tell you something. There's a documentary called Knives Over Forks, which if you've never heard of it, you really need to check it out. It's intensely serious, and it's extremely informative. And you got to look at this, because what the trip is, and they used, you know, several examples, but, you know, document examples that have been going on since actually the late 40s. You know, internationally, there have always been people working on diet and how to deal with cancer. But when they come forth with their findings that basically a meat-based diet will damage you, that smoking will damage you, that the exhaust from fumes from vehicles, you know, petroleum, byproducts, will damage the body, break it down. But your diet is what is most important, what you take in. I mean, most people don't drink one clear glass of water a day. Not that they don't have access to clean water, they just don't do it. They drink soda instead, or some other, you know, sugar-laden, non-food item that has nothing to do with nutrition. And one of the ways that they base, I know I'm going on a tangent, but follow me with this.
What I'm trying to say is they know for a fact that they found out that when the Nazis had occupied the Netherlands, that they, you know, saved all of the hogs and the livestock for their own troops, you know, to feed their own men. In the meantime, the Dutch were forced to eat a vegetarian diet. Well, guess what happened? Evidently, I assume the cancer rate stayed the same for the Nazis, but the Dutch, the cancer rates damn near disappeared. They sank to an all-time low, and then after the occupation, things went back to quote-unquote normal. You know, they went back to their old diet, you know, which is a lot of pork, right? And hey, you know, a lot of fried food, fried everything, damn near, right? You know, and the health went right back to where it was. The cancer rates went right back to where it was. The health in general, the general health, the well-being of the Dutch population went back to what it was. You know, it's pretty clear that the only reason they, you know, will stop that type of research, stop that kind of thing, is because it's interfering with commerce. And this is where I'm coming in with these black conservatives, because be it Oprah Winfrey, and, you know, I'm not trying to single her out. I'm just saying, somebody like Oprah Winfrey, you know, she's getting paid. She's getting paid. If she's not getting paid, then somebody needs to explain to me what then is her attraction. See, this is what I'm talking about in terms of black conservatives as opposed to, you know, black Republicans. It's not the same thing. Yeah, the Republican Party is conservative, but that's not what I'm talking about. You know, what I'm talking about is a conservatism that is really no different than what they're doing. See, the thing is, when you look at somebody like Magic Johnson, I'm not saying he doesn't have his interests, he doesn't have his well-being of the African community at heart. I'm not saying that at all. And you know, and anybody who says that I said that is completely taking me out of context. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, you know, all of the the model, the platform that Maya Angelou, that Barack Obama, that Magic Johnson, you know, or Rihanna, if you want to get down to it. I mean, what is it with these goddamn blonde black women? These are the conservatives of the African population. Why don't people understand this? You know, I just like I said with the Nation of Islam. I respect the Nation of Islam. You hear the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, you'll hear Elijah Muhammad on this show. You know, I mean, don't ever think that I have a problem, per se, with the Nation of Islam. But I'm calling it as it is. The Nation of Islam is the far right of the African community. Why is this impossible? Why do African people have no clear understanding of their own political schema? It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to me. But then again, it does make sense, because when we look at what happened to Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, we look at what happened to Bunchy Carter, we look at what happened to Geronimo Pratt, we look at what happened to the Ruba bin Wahad, we look at what happened to the brothers that are still sitting in isolation in Louisiana. Because I forget what they were actually sent up there for, or even if they actually did it. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't remember the circumstances right offhand. I don't have the information in front of me. But I tell you what, the warden of that joint down there says that they're in isolation because they refuse to recant being Black Panthers. Now, after, you know, COINTELPRO was outed, and then, you know, it was proven in court that Fred Hampton was assassinated, and we have the documented testimony of the black man, the brother, who was working as a snitch, who set him up. And then we have John Burge in the city of Chicago. And what the hell did he do? And how many brothers were sent to the joint over that? Ruined their lives permanently. And he was, what, one of six that they're aware of that they actually, like, have something on. But we're talking about a paradigm. You know, you can go ahead and punish these particular individuals. That's not changing the situation one iota. It's not changing the situation 1/88th of one iota. You know, it's not doing anything. It's not that, you know, it's not causing a drop. It's not causing a change. And as I said, the black conservatives, where are they? Barack Obama, Maya Angelou, Oprah Winfrey, Jay-Z is a conservative. Oh, he votes for the Democratic Party. So what? My parents are both Democrats, voted Democratic their whole lives, man, but they were conservatives. They sounded just like Republicans until they went to the poll. There was no difference between them and the crapola that the Republican Party was talking, you know, back in the day. I mean, look, the whole thing is, and this is where I laughed at Alan West last week.
Well, I laugh at him all the time, but I really laughed at him because he came up with some nonsense. And I'm not talking about the one that's talking about, you know, Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi get out of the country. That was just stupid. Especially when he came right around and said, I never said that, when it's I mean, it's on film, right? I was getting ready to say tape. You know, it's on video. It's on file, right? So, you know, it's there. And he turned right around and said, I didn't say that, and he took me out of context. Like Santorum, I didn't say black people. I said blah people. Now, you know, nobody really accepts this. We're all looking at this and laughing and pretending that the emperor has no clothes. We know exactly what the hell is going on. The Republican Party does not have a policy on anything. They don't have a platform. They know that they can't win. And, you know, as much as I complain about Obama, the bottom line is he did what? He saved the empire, right? He saved the system from a pretty certain goddamn collapse. You know, he took your money and gave it to the rich. And he saved the system. These fools act like they would have done something different. They would not have. But as usual, they haven't had an original idea since Eisenhower left. And even then, when he told everybody what was going on, after, you know, when he was on his way out the door, nobody listened to him. In his own party, I'm talking about, nobody listened to him. Well, nobody in the Democratic Party listened to him either. And you need to ask yourself why we stuck to two goddamn parties when everybody else around the world has parliamentary government. Yeah, I know. That's a real left thing to say. But I'm not left wing, so ha-ha. You know, it's so hard to explain to people. You know, I've said it on this show a million times. I've been saying it for the past 10 years on this goddamn show. Look, I am indigenous. That is what I deal with. That is where I'm coming from. If you don't know it in English, look it up. Indigenismo. Look it up. Don't believe me. But ask yourselves, you know, are these conservatives doing anything? Now, where are the radicals then? On the left. Well, I just mentioned some. That's about anybody that served with the Black Panther Party. These are considered the radicals, even though they didn't do anything radical. They did everything that any group of people should do under the same circumstances. They were not being brought into the system. We were not being brought into the system, right? Which is already corrupt to its goddamn core, because the only reason the African is in the Americas in the first place is because we were brought here. And I still haven't talked about how many of our brothers and sisters were tossed overboard as damaged goods or destroyed here or have lost their minds because of this system. So the Black Panther Party for self-defense was dealing with something that isn't being dealt with by the black conservatives, police brutality. And from that grew a movement. They were feeding more children than the federal goddamn government, and it didn't cost the goddamn government a goddamn dime. And see, you know, that was bad, because they took themselves off the tit of the system. Now here you have Gingrich, Santorum, Paul, with his goddamn crazy-ass Rumpelstiltskin type of political Austrian economics nonsense. He needs to go to Austria, where there's real Nazis. You know, he'll be right at home. You know, I mean, he needs to do that. Hitler was from Austria. That's what he needs to do. All of these people need to go. You know, the black man and woman in the United States and the Indian has been trying to stand on their own goddamn feet as long as we've been in this goddamn country. As long as we've been in the Americas. But, you know, you'll never know that if you listen to these fools. And I'm talking about the Republicans. Be they black, white, and the black conservatives. I don't give a damn if they belong to the Democratic Party. I don't care if they gave them their last entire proceeds from their last project. The bottom line is, you got a bunch of blonde women out here who are black and who don't want to be,
and a lot of black people who have status who don't want to lose it. So they're willing to stand by and watch you lose everything so that they can keep what they have. This is the Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is DJ Fusion of the Fusebox Radio Broadcast at BlackRadiosBack.com, and you're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. Alright, peace.
This is Immortal Technique. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war in which tens of thousands of civilians were killed. We are told to look upon these deaths as an exaggeration or an acceptable loss in the war on terror. But this administration has lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, and produced phony news reports. People have been imprisoned without charges and tortured, and illegal weapons used. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor a foreign investigation. Peace.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and FirstVoicesIndigenousRadio.org.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, healthcare, including reproductive health, was women's business and respected as such. Reclaim your healthcare choices by keeping yourself informed and sharing information with your relatives. Inform yourself about Plan B, known as the morning after pill. Plan B will protect you from becoming pregnant after a sexual assault or unprotected sex if taken within 72 hours. Make sure your local Indian Health Service facility carries Plan B. It does not require a prescription and should be provided upon request. It's your right. For more information, call your local healthcare facility. This message is brought to you by Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male? who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And goddamn the Democrat.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. aboriginalpress.blogspot.com.
This is Michael Parenti, and welcome to Real History, a series of talks by me on different historical subjects that are relevant for understanding today's realities. Most people are never exposed to real history. In school, we usually don't read history, we read history textbooks, and mainstream ones at that, which avoid underlying realities, and ones that propagate myths that serve the powers that be, myths that some of us find harmful to the truth and to democracy. So this is real history. This particular segment is entitled The Functions of Fascism. Fascism is a name that was given to the political movement that arose in Italy under the leadership of Benito Mussolini, who ruled that country from 1922 to 1943. Nazism, a similar movement led by Adolf Hitler, was Germany's dictator from 1933 to 45. It's considered by most observers to be a variant of fascism, as to a lesser degree is the militaristic government that controlled Japan from 1940 to 45, and the Falangist movement led by Francisco Franco in Spain, when the fascists there, with the military aid, by the way, of the Italian and Nazi fascists, took over after a protracted civil war. There are similar fascist or self-avowed fascist movements, but less successful ones arose in Eastern Europe and in Great Britain, the United States, France, and other Western industrial nations' movements. Some of them also came to power. We might recall today, when the press is full of news about how Bulgaria or Romania or Hungary or Lithuania are returning, or Poland are returning to their democratic roots by overthrowing communism, we might recall that they weren't democratic before communism came in. They were fascist. In fact, several of those countries, with the exception of Poland, were open allies of the Nazis. They were Nazi fascist allies. Now, like with a lot of terms, like liberalism, democracy, socialism, communism, no single definition of fascism maybe will satisfy everybody. And with fascism, there's a really special problem, because it's a beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. And the reactionary class politics are the part of fascism that our establishment historians, almost never talk about. Hitler's party, for instance, was called the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP, or Nazis. It's a very left-sounding name, National Socialist German Workers, and it was designed to win broad support among working people, even while the Nazis were destroying working-class organizations. In other words, fascism, the original Italian and German variations of fascism, was a political phenomenon that made a revolutionary appeal without making a revolution. It promised to solve the ills of the many while in fact protecting the special interests of the few with violence and terror. And it propagated a new political consciousness, a new order, a new nation to serve the same old capitalist system. Let me run down a couple of the major characteristics of the fascist ideology. First, there's a glorification of the leadership cult, the commitment to an absolutist and supreme leader, all-knowing, all-guiding, the Führerprinzip, as it's called, the Führer principle, the leader principle, I should say. Second, there's a glorification of the nation-state as an end in itself, as an entity unto itself, an absolute component, to which the individual is subsumed. Everything in the state, everything for the state, nothing outside of the state. That was Mussolini's dictum, and it was Hitler's also. In fact, with Hitler, Rudolf Hess once said, Adolf Hitler is Germany, Germany is Adolf Hitler, therefore combining both the leadership cult and the state cult in one. Third, there was a glorification of military conquest and jingoism, the glory of that the state is vitalized by subduing, conquering, taking other people, enslaving them. You increase your own power and your own glory. Fourth, there was the propagation of a folk mysticism, a xenophobia and a racism. The Nazi slogan was Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. Also, as a other side of the folk mysticism and this blood cult of the special blood, the special legacy, the atavistic wonders of our particular people, was a xenophobia, a hatred and a racism, a hatred of other peoples, other nationalities. With the Nazis and with most other Eastern European fascists, it was anti-Semitism. The Jew was seen as the perpetrator of all that was ill in society. The trade unionists, they were Jews. The communists, so forth and so on. And behind them stood this wicked, alien-blooded creature who would undermine our state. Fifth, there was an opposition, both in Italian fascism and in German Nazism, an opposition to socialism, to communism, to anarchism, and to all left egalitarian class movements and doctrines, along with opposition to trade unions, opposition to labor parties, opposition to other working class political organizations. Of these various characteristics of Nazism, 1, 2, 3, 4 are often talked about by established historians and mainstream historians. That last one, though, opposition to labor unions, opposition to working class parties, opposition to socialism and such, that one is never talked about by Western writers, especially American writers. The historians and the political scientists and the journalists who treat the subject of fascism usually write from a centrist ideological perspective, from the political center of the spectrum, which means they usually ignore the link between fascism and capitalism, just as they tend to ignore the entire subject of capitalism itself when there's something unfavorable to say about it. Instead, they dwell on the more phantasmic components of fascist ideology, the nihilistic revolt against Western rationalism and individuality, the irrational appeals to mass submission to a leader and all that. And fascism was those things, but along with its irrational appeals, it had rational functions. It was a rational instrument for class domination and for the preservation of the existing capitalist system. After World War I, Italy had a parliamentary government that seemed really incapable of solving the country's economic crises. Profits were declining, banks were failing, unemployment was rising. So to ensure profits, the big industrial giants and the big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with tariff protections along with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this, the population would have to be taxed more heavily, their wages rolled back, and social welfare expenditures drastically cut. It sounds like Reaganism. Well, it is, even more extremely so. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications. And through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. And even in the face of this worsening economic crisis, they were able to mount a troublesome defense of their standard of living. I mean, troublesome for those who own the land, the labor, and the capital, and the money, and the banks, and the farms, and the factories. So the only solution really was to smash the worker and peasant organizations, in effect destroying all political and civil liberties, including the right to organize, agitate, and propagandize. The state would have to be more authoritarian and more firmly subservient to the interests of capital. Mussolini and his black shirts were around right after World War I, and through for about 3 or 4 years, the big landowners and industrialists used their fascist goon squads, gave them money and gave them arms, and used them as kind of strike breakers, anti-labor militias. They styled themselves the United Front against Bolshevism. In 1922, the big capital interests in Italy decided to go for the whole thing. Representatives of the Federation of Industry and the Federation of Agriculture, which was a agribusiness firm, and representatives of the National Banking Association, they all met together, and they met with Mussolini, and they planned the fascist march on Rome. Mussolini sat there and planned that with the leading capitalists of Italy. By the way, this is almost never mentioned in the accounts about the March on Rome. These big capitalists contributed 20 million lira toward that undertaking. In the words of Senator Ettore Conti, himself a very loyal representative of the moneyed interests, quote, Mussolini was the candidate of the plutocracy, that is, of the wealthy, and the business associations. A very similar pattern, by the way, of coordination and compliance existed in Germany also, less than a decade later. German workers and farm laborers in the period following World War I under the Weimar Republic won some important economic concessions. They won an eight-hour day, they won unemployment insurance, they were able to elect shop committees, and they won the right to unionize. And again, during the 1920s, these paramilitary right-wing gangs, most notably Hitler's brown shirts, stormtroopers, were subsidized by business in a limited way and kept as a kind of reserve army, what Guérin called the bodyguard of capitalism. And their job again was to strike, break, and to harass, organize workers, and to beat up socialists and communists and such. The nearly total collapse of the German economy in 1929-30 presented the owning class with a momentous crisis. They had very big capital investments, and these left them with very high fixed costs that had to be met even as their plants lay idle. Only massive state aid could revive their profits. Wages and social welfare, human service expenditures had to be cut. Union contracts had to be abrogated. In fact, human contracts had to be abrogated too. Business would need new subsidies and tax exemptions. The crisis in agriculture was equally severe, and the large landed proprietors, Junker class, demanded even higher subsidies, heavier duties on foreign agricultural imports, and an end to farm unions. These unions were holding wages up, and when wages were being sustained, you cut into profits. So by 1930, most of the influential landowners and big industrialists and bankers, especially the industrialists in steel, coal, and mining, had concluded that the Weimar Republic no longer served their interests, and no longer could protect their class, that it was too accommodating to the working class and to certain sectors of light industry. So they greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and they propelled the Nazi Party onto the national stage. By 1930, most of the great industrialists and bankers were underwriting the Nazi Party. And what happened in 1930 with this injection of hundreds of millions of marks is that Hitler was able to catapult his party onto the national scene. It went from a cult of brown shirt thugs to a national party mobilized. In the election of 1930, the Nazi Party gained 107 seats in the Reichstag, and Hitler, later on, evoking the memory of what he called that astonishing campaign, told his listeners to think of, quote, what it means when 1,000 speakers, each has a car at his disposal and can hold in a year 100,000 meetings. And in 1931 and 32, the subsidies from the big industrialists continued to grain in ever more abundantly. So the Nazis were projected onto the national stage, and they gained an ever larger presence in the Reichstag. Neither in Italy nor in Germany was revolution really something that was in the offing. I mean, it wasn't a real threat. The left was never strong enough to take state power in either of those countries. So the threat wasn't really from the left. The bourgeoisie resorted to fascism less in response to the disturbances in the street and more in response to the disturbances in their own economic system. The threat wasn't from the left. The threat was from their own economic systems and its contradictions, and the fact that democratic forces had developed enough democratic strength to resist the austerity and the rollback that the capitalists tried to impose to maintain their levels of profit. The sickness that these capitalists tried to banish was from within, not from without. The Italian and German monopolists, the big cartels, also had a direct interest in an expansionist military regime. They wanted a big rebuilding of the military, one that would, one, compensate, first of all, would compensate for the decline in investment opportunities with huge armament contracts and related public works. In other words, this industrial and financial class wanted a large defense budget, as we would call it, because it was a source of capital investment and enormous capital profits. Does that sound familiar? Two, they wanted to embark on an aggressive foreign policy to open new markets for export and investment, thereby gaining a more equal footing with French and English competitors. So the fascists really became a very valuable ally against the capitalists' two worst enemies. The capitalists' two worst enemies are, first, the workers in their own country, and the capitalists of foreign countries. And the genuineness, by the way, of fascism's hatred of workers and foreigners was never open to doubt, so they fit in quite snugly. Now, I don't mean to say that all the big industrialists and financiers supported fascism with equal fervor. Some, like Tyson, were early and enthusiastic backers of Hitler. The aged Emil Kerdorf thanked God that he lived long enough to see the Führer emerge as the savior of Germany. Others contributed money to the Nazis, but also to other anti-socialist parties on the right. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. Some elements in business were not that hot for fascism. Light industry, which had lower fixed costs and more stable profits than heavy industry that was dependent on consumer buying power and such, the light industrialists were not that keen about a more aggressive foreign policy, about heavy subsidies to heavy industry and the like. But when push came to shove, they may not have been close to the fascists, but they weren't about to ally themselves with the proletariat against the business class of which they were a part. And they pretty much sided with the dominant elements or kept their mouths shut. There was another element in these two societies that not only tolerated the rise of fascism, but supported it. And I'm talking about the parliamentary capitalist state itself. Not the government or the parliament as such, but the instruments of the state, the instruments that have the legal monopoly on force and violence, the police, the army, the courts, and the like, the secret intelligence agencies and such. In both Italy and Germany, years before Mussolini and Hitler emerged victorious, these elements, courts, police, the army, showed a real leniency and an open collaboration with fascism while harshly repressing the left. Mussolini and Hitler could not have come to power without the help of the state machineries, and that state machinery was never really against them. In Italy, the police collaborated with the fascists in attacking labor and peasant organizations. They recruited criminals for the fascist action squads, the squadristi, as they call squadristi. They promised them immunity from prosecution for past crimes. When applications for gun permits were regularly denied to workers and peasants, police guns and police cars were made available to Mussolini's goons. Germany, the same kind of thing went on. Immediately after the war, the military police and the judiciary sided with the rightists to suppress the left, a pattern of collaboration that continued to the day that Hitler took power. In other words, these supposed democracies, which were equally opposed to totalitarianism of the left and the right, were not equally opposed. They were opposed to the left, and they were very close and comfy with the right. Because the right, while it was out to destroy that democracy, the right was protecting the interests of property and the existing class structure. And that's the difference between the left and the right, and that's why a capitalist state tends to treat the right so much more leniently and the left so much more harshly. Let's look at what happened by the police and the courts under the Weimar Republic. These are the figures. Left-wing groups were charged with 22 murders. 38 people on the left were found guilty for those 28 murders. They averaged 15 years in prison. 10 of those 38 were executed. Among right-wing groups, 354 murders. What is that? That's about 50 times, 60 times more the number of murders. Of these 354 murders, 326 were not even prosecuted. 23 were discharged. 23 people of the right-wing groups were discharged despite entering guilty pleas. They pleaded guilty to the murder and they were discharged. 24 were found guilty in part. Their average term in prison, 4 months. The number of them executed for the murders, none. So that's the way the state operated. Almost all the literature on fascism and Nazism concentrates on who supported Hitler, who supported Mussolini, who was behind him. Was it this group or that group and such? Oh, there was a couple of millionaires who didn't like them. Oh, there were some workers who did vote for them. So you can't really say it's one class or another. Well, I think you could pretty well say which class gave them the money, that gave them the visibility, the organization, and the numbers to some degree. But there's something else. Besides talking about who supported fascism, one thing these historians and political scientists never talk about is who did fascism support when fascism came into power. Who did the fascists support? Well, in Italy and Germany, when they came into power, they began implementing the stern measures that were needed to rescue the capitalist economy. Labor unions were dissolved. Strikes were outlawed. Union contracts were nullified. Prominent union leaders and other labor activists were imprisoned or murdered. Union property was confiscated. Worker publications were banned. Opposition political parties were outlawed. Their leaders jailed. Civil liberties were suspended. Fascist-sponsored unions, quote, unions, were set up, and their function was to speed up production, prevent wildcat strikes, and apply punitive regulations, including fines, dismissals, and imprisonments against workers who agitated or complained of shop conditions. I mean, even a Nazi labor front newspaper had to admit, quote, some shop regulations are reminiscent of penal codes. Workers no longer had the right to change jobs. They could be shifted from one employment to another regardless of their wishes. They could be conscripted for any work assumed useful to the nation's economy without guarantee of wages equal to previous earnings. In both Italy and Germany, the government exercised compulsory arbitration and regulation of work and wages. By the way, any worker who contested that would be contesting the laws of the state and therefore would be declared an enemy of the state, not just in conflict with management, but an enemy of the state. And so, in effect, what you got was a perfect wedding of the interests of the state and the interests of the capitalist class in this particular capitalist state. And by the way, these measures had their effect. According to figures supplied by the Italian press itself, the already meager wages, you know, the wages weren't all that good to begin with, for Italian workers in 1927 were cut in half by 1932. By 1939, the cost of living had risen 30%, and this constituted an additional decrease in real wages. Taxes on wages were introduced. Regulations were instated against minimum wages. The minimum wage law was abolished, in other words. There was no more increased pay for overtime. In some regions, sanitary and safety regulations were dropped. Occupational safety regulations were eliminated in factories. In many areas, child labor was reintroduced. In other words, all the old abuses and old evils that the Italians thought were dead, that belonged to a generation ago, had returned under fascism. In Germany, the same story. Between 1933 and 1935, wages were lowered anywhere from 25 to 40%. That's a tremendous cut if you're an ordinary worker just trying to make ends meet. Wage taxes were instituted. Municipal poll taxes were doubled. Payroll deductions helped finance the Nazi-controlled labor front. And the Nazi labor front controlled the party organizations and the health and unemployment insurances, all of which, by the way, lowered wages another 20 and 30%. That is, the things that were taken out of your pay for that. And the non-profit mutual assistance and insurance associations that had existed before the Nazis came to power and the free labor unions were abolished. Their funds were taken over by private insurance companies that charged more while paying out smaller benefits. So, and in Italy, in Germany, just like in Italy, inflation substantially added to the German workers' hardship. There's something else both of these fascist leaders did. In both Italy and Germany, the process of privatization. Does that sound familiar? Ronald Reagan's dream. State-owned enterprises such as power plants, steel mills, banks, railways, insurance firms, steamship companies and shipyards were handed over to private ownership for a song, I mean like gifts. Corporate taxes were reduced by half in both Italy and Germany. Does that sound familiar? Another Reagan achievement. Taxes on luxury items for the rich were cut. And inheritance taxes were either drastically lowered or abolished, just as they've been the last 10 years in America. In Germany, between 1934 and 1940, the average net income of corporate businessmen rose by 46%. Enterprises that were floundering were refloated with state bonds. They were recapitalized out of the state treasury, and they were returned to private control when solvent. So you see, these are people who say socialism doesn't work, but when capitalist businesses start to fail, they go socialist. They take the money out of the public treasury and refloat these businesses. Does that sound familiar to you people who are worrying about the S&L bailout? With numerous enterprises, the state guaranteed a return on the capital invested. They guaranteed a return and assumed all the risk of investment losses. So the investor, the rich investor, didn't have to worry about any losses, and if his business didn't do well, he'd get the money from the state treasury. And anyway, this is why the capitalists did like fascism. This, however, did not really bring a final solution. I mean, what the fascist state is, it attempts a final solution to the problem of class conflict. It obliterates the demands of the working class and the democratic forms that allow workers some room for an organized defense of their interests. But this final solution proves very far from final. In fascist Italy and Germany, industrial sabotage and sporadic wildcat strikes continued, inflation increased, whole sectors of the economy remained stagnant, there was widespread corruption, mismanagement, underemployment, vital social services deteriorated, but profits climbed. The profits went up, yes sir. The gestures made on behalf of the needy were pitiful. I mean, what the Nazis used to do is go around in the working class areas and collect alms, so they taxed the poor to give money to the still poorer, as Franz Schumann once said. The Italian economy remained in a troubled, stagnant condition right up to the Second World War. In Germany, thanks to the booming armaments industry, the standard of living, at least most notably the unemployment problem, well, it had been so bad, that standard of living improved a little bit, but it never even reached, by the way, it never even reached what it was in 1933 under the Weimar Republic. I mean, it never reached 1928 levels. So even under the Weimar Republic, for all its troubles, the levels of food, textile, and other areas of consumption and production were much better than ever achieved under Nazi Germany. Anyone interested in reading more about fascism, I would direct you to a very fine book by Daniel Guérin, G-U-E-R-I-N, called Fascism and Big Business. The writings of Franz Neumann are also worth looking at. Now, my references on a couple of occasions here, I've made references to Reagan and Reaganism. I didn't mean to imply that Reagan was a fascist. In fact, quite the opposite. I meant to point out that in the American context, Reaganism met the same crisis that was going on, a similar crisis, it wasn't quite the same, but accomplished the same things within the existing framework, the political framework of the existing political system. He broke unions, but he didn't use death squads and terror squads. He broke them using corporations, advisory corporations, spending hundreds of millions of dollars showing companies how to break unions. They broke unions by instituting one of the most restrictive and prohibitive and difficult laws, the Taft-Hartley Law, that goes back to 1940s, which make union organizing in America so very difficult. They've tried a number of times to limit our constitutional rights, the rights of free speech, the right of government accountability. They've cut inheritance taxes. They've cut the capital gains taxes. They've cut corporate taxes. They've abolished the progressive income tax. These are the accomplishments of the Ronald Reagan administration. While everyone talked about what a nitwit and a dingbat and a fool he was, Ronald Reagan did some very successful and brilliant things for his class. He rolled back the social democracy that had been developing in the late 60s and through the 70s. He cut back undermined human services. He staffed agencies and courts with people in government who do not believe in government and do not even carry out the programs that Congress voted in. So within the American context, he's done quite a few things, short of what Hitler and Mussolini did as a final solution. And today I would also point out that in capitalist democracies in Western Europe and in the United States, the security forces have that same double standard that we discovered in Italy and in the Weimar Republic in Germany. Namely, they look the other way toward violence from the right, or seem to do very little, or seem seldom able to capture the perpetrators, unless the perpetrators are so crazy as to attack and kill police themselves. Then they go after them. But on the left, there's a constant surveillance, harassment, and in fact, sometimes outright murder. One can think of the systematic murder of the Black Panther Party, something like 30 of them killed in coordinated police attacks in cities throughout America. Or one can think of what's going on in West Germany, Italy, Belgium, Portugal today, where people on the left are being thrown in jail for astronomical sentences, while terrorists on the right seem to get by and get away with murder. Well, this is what we have to look at, and we have to understand that fascism is not just another ism out there. It's not just an aberration. It has a very rational side to it. It's a rational, functional form, and it can take diluted forms, and its propensities, its proclivities can exist even in the democratic state. That is, within that state, those police powers and those state powers can manifest some of the very same symptoms and all the worst attributes that you might find in a Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. Don't take my word for it. Just ask the CIA. Thank you. This is Michael Parenti with some real history.
You have been listening to Angrindian Radio. AngrindianRadio.blogspot.com.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.